KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine on if there's still American support for Ukraine and NATO. Also, new findings in the January crash over the Potomac. Then Rupert Everett, the British actor, on his new book of short stories drawn from movie ideas that never quite made it to the screen. It's called The American No. And later, Bear Reinhardt, a musician who doesn't like to be classified as folk, country, or anything.
I really just want to put great songs on a record. I want to make music that does for people what music has done for me.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, February 15, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told European leaders in Munich today that Russia continues to arm itself and that Europe must unite to protect the continent. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv.
Speaking at the Munich Security Conference, Zelensky recalled a phone call with Trump about setting up negotiations to end Russia's war on Ukraine.
Not once did he mention that America needs Europe at the table. That says a lot. The old days are over when America supported Europe just because it always had.
Zelensky said Europe should focus on creating its own army and a united security policy that does not rely on the United States. He said President Trump respects allies that are strong. Ukraine is in talks to join the European Union, and Zelensky wants the EU to be part of any talks to end the war. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Justice Department is asking a court to drop corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. This has prompted several federal prosecutors to resign. As NPR's Carrie Johnson reports, the turmoil at the Justice Department is intensifying.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Hagan Scotton resigned his post in Manhattan after sending a letter to say prosecutors cannot use their vast power to lean on elected officials. Scotton earned 2 Bronze Stars in military service and clerked for Chief Justice John Roberts. He wrote that he expected senior leaders at Justice would eventually find someone who's enough of a fool or a coward to file a motion to dismiss the case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams, but it was never going to be me. Ultimately, it's up to Judge Dale Ho to formally dismiss the corruption case. The judge may decide to hold a hearing to explore the pressure Acting Deputy Attorney General Emil Bovee put on line prosecutors. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Sweeping federal layoffs within the U.S. government in recent weeks are prompting demonstrations in cities across the nation, including in Milwaukee. Mayon Silver from member station WUWM reports on a protest yesterday.
People chanted shame on Trump and wielded signs that said we support federal workers as they bundled up in big coats, scarves, and mittens, braving the frigid Wisconsin weather. Among those who gathered was Renee Medved. She works for the Milwaukee branch of the National Labor Relations Board.
I do not work for Elon Musk. I work for American people.
Through tears, she said, it's been a tough few weeks contending with confusing messaging, including the Trump administration's fork in the road memo and hearing claims that federal workers aren't productive. She said she will continue doing her job, defending workers' rights. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Milwaukee.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Hamas released 3 Israeli men today who had been held hostage since the Hamas-led attack on Israel in October of 2023. In exchange, Israel is releasing 369 Palestinian prisoners and detainees in Israel. This is the 6th coordinated release of hostages and prisoners under a ceasefire agreement that went into effect last month. Rebels backed by Rwanda have captured the 2nd largest city in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Congo's army has retreated. Emmett Livingstone reports from Kinshasa.
Rebels from the Rwanda-backed M23 have captured Bukavu, a city of about 1 million people in eastern Congo. It's the 2nd major city that the group has captured in recent weeks, having seized Goma, the region's main trading hub, in late January. There was little to no fighting for Bukavu, according to the UN and other sources. Congo's army, which hasn't yet commented, appears to have retreated. It's unclear how far this conflict will go. The M23 has vowed to march on the capital, Kinshasa. Congo's President Felix Tshisekedi this week restated his long-standing opposition to negotiating with the M23, which he considers a Rwandan proxy. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
Hong Kong's first locally born giant panda cubs are 6 months old today. A contest is underway on what to name them. They're currently identified as elder sister and little brother. The people who care for them say elder sister appears more active, exploring the enclosure and climbing the tree inside. Little brother mainly likes to wander around and play with the plants. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The Trump administration and its DOGE cost-cutting team continue to crash into more federal agencies, shutting down ongoing work, firing thousands of federal employees. It is a historic reach for power by the Trump administration in full public view, almost hour by hour. But as NPR's Chris Arnold reports, that approach may undermine the president's chances of getting the courts to go along.
This past week, the president let the cameras and reporters into the Oval Office to talk with him and Elon Musk about the DOGE team's actions, many of which are already getting hung up in the courts.
I hope that the court system is going to allow us to do what we have to do. We got elected to among other things, find all of this fraud, abuse, all of this horrible stuff going on.
The examples of fraud Trump has offered up actually just appear to be programs that he doesn't like. There is serious concern, though, from legal experts on the left and the right about these sweeping and abrupt moves, whether that's freezing broad swaths of federal money approved by Congress, gaining access to sensitive Treasury payment systems, or trying to shut down entire agencies overnight. Adam White is with the conservative American Enterprise Institute. He says these moves don't appear to be carefully thought out and explained, and that makes judges more likely to be confused and skeptical.
From the chaos in and around the administration to the chaos in the courts who are trying to grapple with it, and for all of us who are watching it happen, we can all agree this is no way to run a country.
Okay, so how likely is it that the courts will go along with the more extreme moves by the president and his DOGE team? Deborah Perlstein is a constitutional scholar at Princeton University and served in the Clinton White House.
It's really important to understand what's happening now in the federal government, not in terms of what's happening to any one agency or any one program, but as a systematic effort to disable all the checks on executive power. That is, whatever the president says goes.
But she says, here's the thing, this administration doesn't seem to be rolling out this DOGE restructuring effort in a way that would be in its own best interest, legally speaking.
Every other presidential administration in modern American history spends a fair bit of time explaining in legal language and in legal arguments why what they're doing is actually legal, even if it appears like a huge power grab and almost certainly beyond the scope of the president's power, they have some argument.
But she says so far that is basically not happening in the second Trump administration. She says the conservative Supreme Court might be sympathetic to some of the ways the president appears to want to expand his powers. But she says you learn quickly in the White House, you don't try to do anything without having some really good lawyers in the room, making sure you're going about it in the right way. She says the approach here seems to be, we're just going to do this and let the lawyers figure it out later.
That seems to me pretty likely with some of the Doge stuff to be what's going on. And in part for that reason, a lot of that stuff is going to get struck down by the courts pretty quickly.
And that is already now starting to happen. On Thursday, two different federal judges blocked the Trump administration's attempt to shutter USAID, in part ordering it to lift the funding freeze on foreign aid. For his part, Adam White with AEI says, well, he's not a fan of the administration's chaotic moves so far.
The only question is whether this is just an exceptional flurry of new policymaking energy in the first weeks of the administration, or if this is going to be the style of governance for four entire years. I tend to think that this is going to mark the first few weeks or even month or two of the administration, and then things will clarify and slow down. We'll see.
Certainly, this is not the first administration that announced big plans to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse in government. Linda Bilmes is a government efficiency expert with the Harvard Kennedy School.
Under President Reagan, there was something called the Grace Commission, and he charged the commission to work like bloodhounds. Don't leave any stone unturned in your search to root out inefficiency.
But she says both Reagan and President Clinton worked within the system. Clinton wanted input from civil servants to find cost savings. Reagan worked with Congress to pass lasting legislation. Bilmes says so far what she's seeing now, though, is more of a clumsy attack on the system.
Not only is this effort not accomplishing the task of weeding out inefficiency, but it's like cutting off your arm to lose weight.
She says it might seem like it would work for a minute, but it creates a lot more problems than it solves. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Is the United States trying to end the war in Ukraine without Ukraine's agreement? President Trump has said he spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The two ultimately expect to meet to broker an end to the fighting. His Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, said Kyiv should not expect to get back all the territory that Russia's occupied, and it is just not realistic for Ukraine to join NATO as part of any agreement. A day later, he then said everything's on the table. John Herbst is former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine under President George W. Bush. He's now senior director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center and joins us from the Munich Security Conference. Thanks for being with us, Ambassador.
My pleasure.
What do you make of what you've seen and heard in Munich over the past couple of days?
It's been a very tumultuous 2 days here, following a tumultuous two or three days in Washington regarding the Trump administration's efforts to end this war, Russia's aggression in Ukraine. You mentioned the statement that Hegseth had made, which disturbed many people, Ukrainian and European, and for that matter, American. But that was kind of walked back by an interesting party, J.D. Vance, in that interview he gave, what was reported in the Wall Street Journal two or three days ago. Yeah. And as you pointed out in your lead-up, Hegseth himself walked it back a little bit, too. I just came from a big Ukraine lunch sponsored by the Viktor Pinchuk Foundation that featured General Kellogg, who I think gave a very strong description of the policy to a somewhat skeptical audience. And I'm not going to say he completely won them over, but he certainly, I think, made some progress in that direction.
So in your estimation, Mr. Ambassador, The United States is not, if I might be blunt, abandoning Ukraine?
I don't think that's happening at all. I think that there may be some influential voices in Trump world that would like to do that. But I think that the approach the Trump administration has laid out could, not saying would, but could lead to a durable peace. But we've seen some steps in the wrong direction over the past 5 days. You know, there was a point there when, you know, President Trump seemed to be giving priority to his connections with Putin. Mm-hmm. But even when he was doing that, he said, you know, Russia may want to go beyond the lines that would be established by a ceasefire, and we can't allow that. And I think that sort of remains what they're trying to do. you get a ceasefire kind of in place with some adjustments, and an end to the fighting.
Might many of the countries that share a border with Ukraine, Norway, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, think they could be next in Russia's sights if Moscow ends up being rewarded with part of Ukraine?
You know, if you look back at the things Putin has said for years, if you look back at those two draft treaties that he sent, one to us and one to NATO in December of 2021, 2 months before the big invasion, his aims go well beyond Ukraine. And if, in fact, Putin were to win in Ukraine because of weak American policy and weak Western policy more broadly, there's no question that other countries, including NATO countries, would be vulnerable. The most vulnerable, of course, would be the three Baltic states, but also Poland to a lesser extent and Romania.
Mr. Ambassador, J.D. Vance, the vice president, shook up some European leaders this week with a speech he gave this week.
The threat that I worry the most about vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's not any other external actor. And what I worry about is the threat from within, the retreat of Europe from some of its most fundamental values.
What do you make of that remark and European leaders hearing that phrase, the threat from within?
Clearly, that was the talk of the town of Munich, after he gave that speech. People were at a minimum irritated, some indignant. And that reflects, you know, the very different view that the Trump team has on such issues as misinformation and censorship, and where their outlook is rather different than that of most of the European states. Not all, but most.
What's the future of the NATO alliance, given all the questions right now?
Well, I don't think that Secretary Hegseth has done that well in addressing the Russia's aggression in Ukraine, but I think he gave significant reassurances to our NATO allies on America's commitment to the alliance. But of course, he sounded the theme that Trump sounded during his first term and again now, that Europe must do a lot more in its own defense. And the Europeans, it's really quite interesting watching the dynamic here in Munich. The Europeans are beginning to come to grips with that. And that's a good thing.
Europeans are coming together regardless of U.S. policy or because of it?
Well, I think they understand if the U.S. steps back a little bit, they're going to have to step up. And we're beginning to see a serious conversation about the need to do that on the part of the Europeans. That wasn't true 3 or 4 weeks ago.
John Herbst, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, speaking with us from the Munich Security Conference. Mr. Ambassador, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
And you're listening to NPR News.
With these headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky today called for the creation of a European army. He told the annual Munich Security Conference the continent can no longer be sure of U.S. protection. Tens of thousands of protesters are demonstrating in Serbia today, calling for an end to corruption. The protests began after a roof collapsed at a newly renovated train station 3 months ago, killing 15 people. And hockey players from the U.S. and Canada are to compete tonight in Montreal in the Four Nations face-off. Canadian sports fans have been booing the U.S. national anthem since President Trump threatened tariffs and suggested Canada become the 51st state. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. There's new information about what happened in the final minutes before an Army Black Hawk helicopter and an American Airlines regional jet collided in midair last month near Ronald Reagan National Airport outside of Washington, D.C. The National Transportation Safety Board says the pilots of the helicopter may not have heard a critical instruction from air traffic control. The crash on January 29 killed all 67 people on board both aircraft. It is the deadliest aviation disaster in the U.S. in 24 years. Aviation reporter David Shaper joins us. David, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott.
I gather this latest information offers some detail on what the Black Hawk helicopter pilots may not have heard.
Right. The National Transportation Safety Board investigators outlined the exact paths both aircraft were flying that Wednesday night. One important thing to note about aviation, which is the safest mode of transportation, is that even experienced, skilled pilots often undergo training and retraining, and they are tested on their skills. So the Black Hawk helicopter was on what they call a check ride, in which the crew is being tested on their use of night vision goggles and flying by instruments. And they were flying along this familiar corridor along the Potomac, while the American Airlines CRJ regional jet was approaching for a landing at Reagan National Airport. Investigators say cockpit voice recordings indicate that an air traffic controller seemed concerned that the helicopter was flying toward the path of the incoming plane and asked the Black Hawk pilots to fly behind it. Here's NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy.
So the instructions from ATC were to pass behind the CRJ. That transmission was interrupted. It was stepped on.
Homendy says the mic in the helicopter cockpit was keyed open for just a second or two, but the pilots may have missed the key words, passed behind the. That's critical instruction that had the pilots actually heard and followed, this disaster might have been averted.
We've also heard that the helicopter may have been flying too high at an altitude that put it near the path of the plane. Any new information on that?
Yes. You know, Homendy says the helicopter pilots might not have been receiving correct information about their exact altitude. Homendy says a radio altimeter, which uses radio waves bounced off the ground to measure the aircraft's altitude, and information gleaned from a flight data recorder were in conflict and showing different altitudes.
We are looking at the possibility of there may be bad data. We're looking at, were they seeing something different in the cockpit that differs from the FDR data, which was radio altimeter.
Homendy says it's still not clear why there was erroneous or conflicting data, and the investigation is still in its early stages, but she says this is definitely something the NTSB is focusing on.
We've also heard about the speculation that the two pilots just may not have seen each other's aircraft. The crew of the helicopter in particular may have mistaken another plane for the one into which they crashed. What do investigators say about that now?
Well, investigators did say that the crew of the American jet did pull up aggressively just before the impact, indicating that they likely saw the helicopter at the very last moment. In addition, they did confirm the Black Hawk crew was likely wearing night vision goggles, and they acknowledged there is some concern in an area with a lot of aircraft lights and city lights that it could have been difficult to see the airplane. Chair Homendy says the NTSB will conduct a visibility study to try to determine what the pilots could and could not see.
Aviation reporter David Shaper, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
The top federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C. has an unusual backstory. He has no prior experience prosecuting violations of the law. He does, however, have experience defending people accused of breaking the law after the Capitol riot on January 6th. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson has this report.
One day before the siege at the Capitol on January 5th, 2021, Ed Martin appeared before a boisterous crowd with this message.
Stop the steal! Stop the steal! Stop the steal!
Martin advanced bogus claims about election fraud in swing states in 2020.
So thank you for standing with all of the patriots next to you. And thank you for standing for our president. But remember, what they're stealing is not just an election. It's our future.
The Justice Department went on to charge more than 1,500 people with crimes at or near the Capitol 4 years ago. And Ed Martin went on to defend a few of them in court and to sit on a board that offered financial support to their families. Last year, he told the Unimpressed podcast, 99% of the Capitol defendants were normal people.
I've never seen anything so unfair in terms of what's how they're characterized, how these people are characterized, insurrectionist and felonious and all this stuff.
Now back in office, President Trump has granted clemency to all of the January 6th defendants, and he picked Ed Martin as the interim U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C. Martin's fired about two dozen prosecutors who worked on those January 6th cases, and he's launched a review over how the DOJ used an obstruction charge against many of the rioters.
Now, this review of the use of the obstruction charge is outrageous and nonsense.
Randall Eliason led the public corruption unit in the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office for years.
There is no grave injustice here, no misconduct by the people in bringing these cases. They were doing their jobs, and to have the new U.S. attorney come in and just sort of purge the office and suggest that the entire thing was some kind of misconduct, I can't imagine what that's going to do to the morale in the office.
Martin's been posting on the social media site X. He's promised to investigate people who get in the way of or threaten the DOJ team making cuts to federal agencies. He wrote billionaire Elon Musk that he would chase people who acted illegally or unethically to the ends of the earth to hold them accountable. Randall Eliason says prosecutors build criminal cases. They don't investigate breaches of ethics.
I mean, if you look at Martin's background, he has no experience as a prosecutor. He's a politician, and that's exactly how he's acting.
This week, seven House Democrats wrote the Justice Department watchdog, asking him to investigate Martin for possible ethics violations. They say Martin moved to dismiss one Capitol rioter's case while he was still listed on paperwork as the man's defense attorney. Martin did not return a request for comment for this story, but in an interview with WJLA-TV, he said it was an honor to serve as U.S. attorney, and he says he's been in close contact with police in Washington.
And we've talked since then almost every day about how do we get the streets safer, how do we protect kids, how do we protect seniors.
Martin says he wants to protect the D.C. community, but longtime defense lawyers here say some of Martin's social media posts could wind up as evidence in court if he moves to prosecute critics of Musk and DOJ. Sarah Croft says juries could be an important check on prosecutors in the city.
It's a smart jury pool. It's a focused jury pool. It's an open-minded jury pool, but it's one that also understands the politics of what's happening.
Now more than ever, Croft says, it's important for D.C. residents to show up for jury duty. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
The movie scenes just rip your heart right out of your chest, is it? For example, when Rose gives the frozen Jack the old heave-ho into the North Atlantic in Titanic.
I'll never let go. I promise.
Or maybe it's an Inside Out when Riley's imaginary friend Bing Bong sacrifices himself to get joy out of the memory dump.
Go! Go save Riley!
Take her to the moon for me, okay?
Oh, I just can't take it. Later today on All Things Considered with Scott Detrow, find out what other movies unleash the waterworks, including those tear-jerking moments that just come out of nowhere. Listen with tissues nearby by telling your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. But I've recovered. And now it's time for sports. Dynasties clash in college hoops. Women's sports continues to rise, and just a wonderfully heartwarming story out of Buffalo. Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us. Hi there, Michelle.
Heidi-ho, Scott.
Heidi-ho. I like that. Listen, yeah. Let's begin with women's college basketball, because tomorrow South Carolina, the current champions, face UConn. These are two programs that have dominated women's basketball for the past 15 years. Neither of them happen to be ranked in the top three at the moment. What do you expect?
Well, they are top 10. And we should see them, could see them, deep into March. And, of course, led by two coaching icons, Scott and Don Staley and Gino Auriemma. Really interesting stakes here for both sides. You know, South Carolina is looking to bounce back because they took a somewhat surprising loss to Texas last weekend. That ended their 57-game win streak in SEC regular season play. So they don't want to turn that into a two-game losing streak by losing to UConn tomorrow. For UConn, this is really a prove-it game. You know, it's hard to believe because when I think of women's basketball dominance, I do think of all those UConn teams, you know, that won in the 2000s and the 2010s, but they haven't won a national championship in almost a decade. Wow. And that's got to be killing Gino. I'm sure he'd love to have another trophy on his mantle. So this will kind of prove that they belong in the conversation for that potential national championship this year.
Michelle, you've spent the week reporting on this extraordinary moment in women's sports. Attendance is growing. Pro leagues are expanding. You found that a lot of it has to do with how college athletes can now get sponsorship money for their name, image, and likeness.
Yeah, this was a really interesting report that I worked on for ESPN. There was some trepidation at first when NIL was first allowed back in 2021, at least among some in women's sports, that, you know, the guys would get all the money. But women have really taken the ball here and run with it. Players are building huge followings on social media. And these companies like Nike or State Farm or Adidas, they're signing these players in college and then amplifying those same players to millions of fans for the duration of their career or as they go to the pros. And Scott, you know, it's like anything in sports. Fans love stars. And when you build stars, audiences follow.
I got to ask you about just a wonderful story in football this week. Quarterback of the Buffalo Bills, Josh Allen, gave a special shout-out last week when he won his first NFL MVP award to thank the Bills' mailman, a man they call Slick Rick. And a little more to the story here, isn't there?
Yeah, I thought this was so cool. And, you know, it sort of harkens to a saying that you hear around NFL facilities all the time, right? Football is the ultimate team sport. And boy, does that extend to everybody in the facility. Josh Allen, of course, the Bills quarterback, gave special thanks to Rick Morrow. He works in the mailroom in Buffalo. He's known by a nickname, Slick Rick. And Morrow ended up doing an interview with a local TV station. He said when he heard his name on national television, he broke down because, quote, I'm just an average person. This is all like a dream. So a local car dealership in the Buffalo area heard, you know, his tearful words and reached out. They found out that he had been taking the bus to work for 15 years, and they gifted him a brand new car, a Chevy Traverse to be exact. And so now he can drive to work and presumably listen to a lot of Bills content on the radio.
I have to ask, the New York Jets and Aaron Rodgers are so over. They said they're not going to keep the 41-year-old quarterback next season. Aaron Rodgers will be a free agent. He is a future Hall of Famer, but do you think any team wants to sign him?
Well, you know, as a former Green Bay Packers quarterback, I guess you could say his destiny after being on the Jets is to sign with the Vikings, but the Vikings are actually okay at quarterback. You know, from what I've heard, the issues with Aaron Rodgers, his declining athleticism, his age, of course, 41, his reputation for clashing with front offices, and lots of off-the-field issues. So it's going to take a team that really needs somebody under center to sign him. But you know what, Scott? Those teams do exist.
Yeah, I'll say.
Raiders, Steelers.
Yep.
To name a few.
Exactly. Michelle Steele of ESPN, we mark your words. Thanks for being with us.
You bet.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Many immigrants are pushing back against President Trump's crackdown on migrants in the country without legal status, and a new song has become something of a rallying cry. This song, Donaldtron, is sung by a group of Venezuelans, as NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran brings us the story.
Okay, you need to listen to this sick beat. The song is called Donaldtron. That's how many Spanish language speakers call President Donald Trump. The artists go by Junior Caldera, Davidcito 59, and Luxor, all Venezuelans. And the song has many powerful lyrics. I contribute to this nation. I follow the law, the song goes. I work in construction. I don't deserve to be deported. Luxor, a 23-year-old artist who just moved to Orlando, is the creator of the song. He tells me Donaldtron is the product of his side hustle. Luxor went to wait outside a California Home Depot to find work as a day laborer, but after waiting and waiting, no one picked him up. I couldn't find work, and I got this idea in my head that I had to create a song, he says. He was hoping to become famous and live off his music. Part of the song mirrors his immigration journey. God, guide Donald Trump so he doesn't end La Cita. He's referring to CBP One, a mobile app used by asylum seekers to schedule entry into the US while they wait for their asylum claim to be heard. That's how Luxor got into the country. But Trump shut down the app on his first day in office. The music video of Donaldtron is crazy. There's a mock arrest by immigration officers, there's booty shaking, and there's a guy wearing a mask of President Trump dancing dembow like a pro. The song is a comedy with a conscience, Luxor says, adding immigrants relate to it because the lyrics express a reality many of them have lived. Here's Davidcito 59, one of the singers. I went through the Darién Gap and was not eaten by jaguars, he sings. I fought crocodiles and escaped from the military. Venezuelans are one of the fastest growing immigrant groups in the US, and now the ones with a viral song. Luxor, the main writer of the song, may now have a viral TikTok hit, but he's not quitting his day job at a hot dog stand. He still has to get Wi-Fi from a parking lot hotspot. He says everything is possible. I'm still looking for Wi-Fi. I'm making all of my dreams a reality, spreading a message. So let's end this story with how Donaldtron ends. Donaldtron, por favor, vamos a querernos. Donald Trump, please, let's love each other. More of a plea than a hope as the president continues to promise mass deportations. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Austin.
Donald Trump. Me presento, soy un venezolano, ando en busca del progreso como muchos de mis hermanos. Pasé selva, 10 países, caminando bien temprano, extrañando a mi familia por un sueño americano. Un mensaje para todos mis amigos que se encuentran en la lucha dentro de Estados Unidos. Hagan plata honradamente y no se queden dormidos. Y por más que sea difícil, no hagan gasto delictivo. Bendecido en cada situación, en la mañana bien temprano, vendo arepi pabellón.
This is NPR News.
A new thriller set among feuding farmers in Ireland deals with some weighty issues. Masculinity, violence, and yeah, all those sheep.
They were difficult because, you know, they don't really take direction. Kind of have their own method.
Director Christopher Andrews on his movie, Bring Them Down. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The militant group Hamas released another three hostages today. They were freed in exchange for more than 360 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, rebels backed by Rwanda have captured Bukavu, the second largest city in eastern Congo. The rebels had seized the largest city last month. And the National Transportation Safety Board says the crew of the Army helicopter that collided with an American Airlines regional jet in Washington last month may have had inaccurate altitude readings and may not have heard instructions from air traffic controllers. All 67 people on board the two aircraft were killed. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. And from ECMC Foundation, at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, President Trump became the latest U.S. president to say he wants to get rid of the penny. Past efforts have enjoyed bipartisan support, but all have failed. NPR's Maria Aspin reports.
I decided to sort through my jar of loose change this week, and I quickly discovered that it was mostly pennies. Nope, there's one more. All right, I've been storing 113 pennies on my bookshelf for years. Great. There are some 240 billion pennies in circulation, according to some estimates. And most of them are, like mine, just sitting around taking up space. Robert Waples is an economics professor at Wake Forest University.
We're the culprits here. We don't value the penny enough to even bring a lot of our change back to the store.
That means the store has to ask the bank for more pennies, and then eventually the mint has to make more pennies, and it loses a lot of money. It costs almost 4 cents to make each new 1 cent coin. Last year, the U.S. Mint lost more than $85 million making new pennies. Now President Trump says he's ordered his Treasury Secretary to stop making pennies. And unlike most of Trump's recent executive actions, this one is getting bipartisan support.
All for it and long overdue.
Philip Diehl is a Democrat who ran the U.S. Mint in the 90s. He's been calling for the end of the penny for decades. In the big picture, eliminating the penny wouldn't save all that much money for the government. But economists say it would make all of our lives better. For example, stores could just round up or down to the nearest 5 cents when we pay with cash. Research has shown that there's no real cost to consumers when stores do this. And it's exactly what Canada has been doing for more than a decade.
I think the lesson is that it's not a big deal. Canada's economy continued to run smoothly.
when they abolish the penny.
That's Robert Triest. He's a professor of economics at Northeastern University. He points out that most transactions aren't even in cash anymore. And even for lower-income consumers, who tend to rely more on cash, the penny just isn't valuable enough to make a difference. Meanwhile, Diehl says that if the government does stop minting new pennies, there might be a little copper lining for the penny hoarders among us.
They might be worth a couple cents in a few years. You won't pay for anybody's college education.
But maybe a penny saved will become slightly more than a penny earned. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
Rupert Everett, I just want you to know, I think The American No is the best book of stories I've read since Chekhov. There are great possibilities in here. We are all very excited, and you'll be hearing from us very soon.
Oh, I'm speechless.
The title of Rupert Everett's book, The American No, is taken from the way American film producers lavish praise on a writer or actor during a meeting and then are never heard from again. He's written 8 stories kindled by ideas that never quite caught fire after such meetings, and they may make you wonder why. Rupert Everett, the actor, has, of course, dazzled on screen for years. Another Country, My Best Friend's Wedding, A Couple of Shreks, The Happy Prince, which he also wrote and directed, and he joins us from the BBC in London. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Everett.
Thank you very much for having me.
Please tell us about this, I'll just say, distinctive encounter in Soho that you had that led to this book of stories.
Well, actually, that, I have to confess, is also a story, but it was inspired by a kind of real event as well. What happened was I was sitting there one day wondering about my life and what to do next and how to make the next step. And, you know, frustrated because I had planned to have a career as a writer, actor, director. It kind of half happened. And then, you know, I pitched and pitched and pitched all my various ideas across this century and a bit of the last. And only one of them really ever managed to make it to the first night, my only film, The Happy Prince. And the others, of course, rested in either just in my head or in screenplay form. And the point about screenplays is if they're not made, they literally don't exist. They're not even ghosts. And that's frustrating because you put in a lot of energy into ideas and stories and then they just die. Then I had the idea of writing them up into a book of short stories to at least give myself a sense of some kind of achievement for them, that they could have some kind of flickering existence at least.
The longest story in the collection, a lot about show business. It's first, it's entitled Cuddles and Associates. That's a corporate name, isn't it?
Yes, it's called the CAA of the egg, sperm, and womb world.
We will explain it. Well, I'll get you to explain it because, frankly, it's hazardous for me.
Well, all these stories are kind of autobiographical in a way because they all star me as the central character. And so the me in this story is a young, ambitious, useless actor who arrives in Hollywood in the early 80s and doesn't really manage to get any traction at all and ends up working in the mailroom at William Morris, at which point he comes across a big matinee idol movie star who is kind of on the skids. This movie star's broke. He's got alimony from 2 marriages already. He's got mortgages, everything. He's got no money at all, and he's not working. And my character manages to sell his sperm to a Turkish supermarket owner's wife. The supermarket owner is a little bit impotent, and she's desperate. She's his second wife, and she wants to have a child. And so I arrange for this movie star to give her his sperm.
Oh, mercy. Can I ask you about the way you grew up?
I grew up in a military family. A lot of my family are Anglo-Indian. Or my grandfather was born in India. My great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather, I think, both died in India. But, yeah, I come from a military-naval background, very, very straight, very conventional. And Aged about six, I discovered Julie Andrews. You know, I think it's very difficult for people to imagine now what it was like for our generation who had no recourse to moving images, no television at first. The cinema was in the local town. And my first visit to a, you know, a classic provincial cinema, you know, those huge old places with dress circles and upper circles, mm-hmm. slightly smelling of sex and toilet cleaner, and where couples would go and make out in the back row and families would sit at the front. I saw Mary Poppins, and it really, that was the one of the most important creative moments, I think, in my life. Julie Andrews became, well, my mother. I decided she was my mother, in fact. And I decided I was Julie Andrews' daughter. And my mother had thrown away an old tweed skirt, and I wore this skirt religiously. And years later, of course, I had a wonderful payoff to this childhood fantasy, because I got the part in Andrei Konchalovsky's film Duet for One, where Julie Andrews was playing the cellist Jacqueline Dupre, who died of multiple sclerosis, and I got to play her protege. So it was very exciting, and it was the beginning of a real relationship with Julie that has spanned three films, and I adore her. When she goes, I'm going.
There's a line that you use to talk about how the theater, how film opened up a world for you. It was a world with all the dials turned up.
Mm-hmm.
Is it still that way?
Well, I don't really know what it's like now, because, you know, when you get older in it, you're kind of settled within your own kind of inverted glitter ball. And I don't really know what's going on in the real world of show business anymore, because, you know, I quite often, luckily, get wheeled out to do something. I'm not really kind of in the thick of it, I wouldn't say. But I think the dials are turned up. Well, maybe they've been turned down a little bit more recently. In the old days, it was an extravagant world. It was very exciting. You know, you got totally lost in it.
Writer, occasionally director and actor Rupert Everett, his new collection of stories, The American No. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Artists reflect their influences, and the musical influences that shaped Bear Reinhart began in the 1980s when he heard artists like U2 and Bruce Springsteen. But they had to share airtime with the gospel music the South Carolina native heard every Sunday. And all of those influences and more can be heard on Bear Reinhart's latest album, Curiosa.
Shine like a diamond so bright, we can find.
Third album he's released under the name Wilder Woods, and joins us now from Franklin, Tennessee. Bear Reinhart, Wilder Woods, thanks so much for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Can I begin with asking you about your grandmother's curio cabinet? I gather that inspired the at least the title of the album, but the whole album too, right?
Yeah, it did. I was actually kind of in the middle of making the record, thinking about the themes on it that were kind of emerging as I was writing for it. And in my studio, an old Coke bottle that has Bear Bryant's face on it. I'm named after Bear Bryant. All my family was from Alabama. And
Bear Bryant, the University of Alabama football coach, we should say.
Correct. And she used to have that on her cabinet, and she lived in Butler, Alabama, a really small town. And we used to go there as a kid, and I loved being there. But she just had all these trinkets on there from places she had been, mission trips she had gone on. So there's Costa Rica and El Salvador, but all the pictures, the family, her first Bible, you know, all the like sort of classic things from her life. And when I was thinking about the record and how much a different kind of music has inspired me, and how much it snuck onto this record, I think maybe first time ever I felt that way. It made me think of that Curiosa cabinet she had, and that's a reason for the name.
Well, here are the names of the few songs on the album, and maybe you can tell me if there's something in the cabinet that's related.
Okay, gotcha.
For example, Swimming in the Ocean.
Turn on your light, babe. Shine it on me. I need it to show.
That would be funny. That's, you know, my grandfather used to work on cars, worked at a paper mill, and always was the guy with that. So that El Camino reference would probably be in that song, probably the closest thing to that cabinet. Mm.
And Devil in My Eyes?
I remember, got that love to give, got
Yeah, there's something to that. I think my grandmother was the piano lady at the church, basically, and so we would play songs around there, and we always tried to play them louder and more rock and roll. So there's definitely a spirit of that.
Tell us about your music, because of course it has been described as rock, indie, folk, country, stomp. I could go on.
Sure.
I don't know. How do you want it to be described?
Yeah, no, I don't think I do care as much. I think I'm getting worse and worse at describing it as I get older. I really just want to put great songs on a record. I want to make music that does for people what music has done for me. You know, it's been something I can lean on at times and been inspiring in ways, made life make more sense when I didn't have the words for it.
And who's this guy, Wilder Woods?
Well, I named the record, this was before I had my third child, I named after my oldest two sons, Wilder and Woods. Oh. And looking back, it was probably the worst marketing decision ever. But, you know,
wait, we'll see about
yeah,
that one day.
Here we are, here we are. The thing was, I really wanted an identity outside of the band I'd been in forever, a band called Need to Breathe, as lead singer of, and I really wanted people to listen to the music for what it was and not what I had done somewhere else. I'm sure that my four-year-old is named Water, so I'm sure he'll be angry. I've thanked him on every record, so hopefully he'll take that as an offering.
What would be in your curio cabinet?
Some sports things for me. I grew up, I went and played football in college at a little school called Furman, and still really love that part. I think some of the church things, playing guitar. I mean, I learned to play guitar. I was vacuumed the church as a job. My dad was the preacher, so that was our job on the weekend. And they left the guitars out sometimes, and that's where I learned to play. But I would go up there and they had chord sheets for the songs. And that's how I learned the chords and started writing songs right away. You know, so I think probably that. And now, you know, it's now that I have three little boys, it's the craziest, most amazing thing what life has turned into. But the memories with them obviously would be a huge part.
Look, I'm not proud of this question, but I have to ask.
Okay.
Is it hard to be named for Bear Bryant and live in Tennessee?
That's a great question. No, it isn't. Not now. I think, you know, it's a funny thing is that not a lot of people know who Bear Bryant is anymore. Younger people don't. And honestly, I grew up in South Carolina where every time I would say in class, you know, my name is, I'd like to be called Bear, everybody would laugh. You know, there was no context for it. When I went to college, I was getting recruited by Alabama. I went down there. They were dedicating a Bear Bryant statue that weekend, and there were 400 kids there named Bear.
Oh.
I was like, whoa, these are my people. I didn't realize that I thought I was the only one.
Bear Reinhardt is Wilder Woods, and his latest album, Curioso, is out this week. Thank you so much for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses, from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Gone and left me crying. After you've gone, there's no denying.